Well, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield Community Radio. I'm Sean Sayre here with you this morning, Thursday, June 6th, 2024, and it's the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion today. That's a milestone day for sure, something to reflect on today as you go about your day. We have a great show coming up for you this morning. We have Dr. Jake Eberwein. He is the project director at Burke 12, and we'll be explaining what Burke 12 is if you don't know what that is. We'll be talking about rural schools, school choice, regionalization, lots of very interesting topics around public schools here today on the show. So I know you're going to want to stick around and listen to all of that conversation, and we'll be here to give it to you. First, let's get to the weather forecast and see what is in store for us. Looks like kind of a gray morning. It hasn't really started raining yet, but I think that's about to change. Let's hear what's in store for us right now.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers likely. Isolated thunderstorms this morning, then scattered thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. Southeast wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Tonight, mostly cloudy with showers likely with scattered thunderstorms in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Lows in the upper 50s. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Friday, mostly sunny. A chance of showers in the afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 50%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Well, it sounds like we might get our first taste of real thunderstorms here for the summer season here in the Berkshires and Pittsfield, so we'll listen for that. Some people like a good thunderstorm. I don't know. I guess if you have a long stretch of time where you don't have any rain or anything, you know, you don't mind that as long as it's not going to be taking down some trees and power lines, which we don't like to have happen.
That's true.
That's right. So good morning, Jake Eberwein. Thanks for being here this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be back. I'm really pleased to be in your studio here, your reorganized studio, which I guess was reorganized quite a few years ago.
It has, yeah.
And I've been running sort of quietly behind the scenes, so it's good to be here with you to talk about the work we're doing today.
And you're obviously no stranger to WTBR's airwaves. No. Back in the day when you were at Taconic High School, you were a frequent guest on the morning show there on the radio station. So
yes,
quite a tradition that we have with this station and with you.
Yeah, I think it's really important that, you know, people outside of schools hear what's happening in schools. And, mm-hmm. you know, you get your information in bits and pieces, a little bit from the newspaper, a little bit from your neighbors, might go to a game or a play. but it's great also to hear sort of what's in the brains of administrators and school leaders and various folks working in the schools, because there's a lot of really incredible work that's happening in schools that is very invisible to the public, but really we should be proud of.
Yeah. And as you said, it's sometimes hard to know what it's really like and how much it's changed. From the days of maybe the people listening to this show when they were in school or if they were ever associated with a school. Things are quite different today than they were back in your day. Wouldn't you say that's accurate?
it's more than accurate. Yeah, I mean, we keep changing the goalposts on this. It used to be like, oh, if you haven't been in the classroom for 10 years, you don't know what it's like. And then it was like 5 years, you know, it's like, Now it's like, if you haven't been in the classroom since COVID, you don't know what it's like. But, you know, a lot of really big changes. I mean, I think clearly social media and access to technology has just changed, you know, a lot of elements, a lot of things that happen in schools, whether it's communication or how students interact, how parents get their information. You know, technology can be an incredible tool to support student learning, but also can be a very destructive tool to distract from the learning. And as you know, in the last year, a lot of schools are making, you know, pretty hard decisions to, you know, to basically lock down phones and really to control the learning environment, which I support, you know, to really, you know, try to get people focused on the work that you know, really schools should be focused on. But in addition to that, every year schools are dealing with a number of new regulatory expectations. And, you know, I think a lot of the things that occur in society, they manifest in schools. You know, schools are really sort of incubators for social change, you know, and whether it's, you know, the ability to, like happened in Vietnam, where wear armbands that protest against war, to things we're doing right now around racial and social justice, that are, you know, conflicts in our society, and really we're grappling with in our schools.
Yeah.
So it's there's a lot. Administrators and school teachers have just a lot that they're managing. And then put on top of that a couple years of interrupted learning.
Right.
And students are coming with learning gaps and social-emotional gaps. And so,
And that's kind of a bubble that's going to work its way all the way through, right? I mean, there are kids that were in kindergarten, first grade during those early years of COVID. And like you said, there are going to be some gaps that have to be worked out as they follow that path through the K-12 experience, I would imagine. And technology, as you mentioned, a double-edged sword in a lot of ways. You can't run a school without technology anymore, although a lot of people would like to think that you could just go back to the desks and the blackboards and pencils. And some of that still, I'm sure, applies. And yet, without technology, you're not really preparing your kids for what they're going to get when they get out of school, are you?
Yeah. No, it's very true. My wife is a nurse, and she got home last night, and she was sitting on the porch with her phone in her hand, and I'm like, aren't you going to pay any attention to me? Like the little whiny pay, look at me, a husband. And what she was doing literally was charting on her phone.
Mm.
So she had to chart her patients. She does a lot of home visitation. And so that's her work. Her work is electronic. It's recording. It's charting. And so, you know, there's really no aspects of work, I think, today that are not going to have an interaction with technology. And
right.
I think that's only going to become probably more amplified as we, you know, have to grapple with artificial intelligence and the impact of that in schools. Mm. But, you know, schools are required now to keep electronic systems just to interface with the Department of Education. Mm. So it's everything from student, you know, management systems to, you know, teacher credentialing and everything in between. Mm. We, BERC 12, which is Berkshire Educational Resources, K-12, are an organization that, you know, was founded in 2015 as the Berkshire County Education Task Force. And we were primarily just a volunteer group that was looking at trying to understand how to grapple with this idea of declining enrollment and really limited resources. And could we organize our schools in a more efficient way to ensure that our kids got high quality education?
And this is something the trend in enrollment heading down at the time. Was that a particular phenomenon for Berkshire County schools that wasn't showing itself in other parts of the state? Is it something that we had to concentrate on because our population was leaving? And then how did COVID sort of change that formula? Because now we're starting to hear that maybe those declines won't be as severe as once thought, right?
Yeah, no, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah,
and those are all really, really good questions, you know. No question that our enrollment has declined pretty steeply since, you know, probably prior to 2000. In 2000, enrollment was it was between 20 and 21,000 kids.
In the whole county, Berkshire County.
In the whole Berkshire County. And today it's sitting at just over 14,000. Mm. So it gives you an idea. You know, we've lost well over 5,000 students, you know, which is a quarter of the population. In that time period. But I want to answer a couple of your questions. One was, the Northeast generally has seen an overall decline, the Northeastern states. But you have to be careful because you've seen growth in urban centers while you've seen decline in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So right now we're working in the Mohawk Trail and the Hollomont school region, and they've seen the same sort of precipitous decline that we've seen in Berkshire County. The good news is that, and Mark Malloy and our friends at Berkshire Regional Planning Commission have done really excellent work doing a lot of projections and forecasting, which have stayed relatively solid, do predict that this steep, steep decline will flatten. We're going to continue to see some decline, but not at the rate that we've seen over the last couple of decades. So, you know, we may settle. I was looking at the numbers this morning, you know, somewhere around 13,000. You know, it's hard to forecast past 2030. We have numbers for 2035 that are around 11,500.
I can't forecast past next week. So,
right.
You know.
Right.
Getting to 2030 is another is another thing. But you that's what you have to do. You're relying on those on those projections and predictions,
right?
To know you know where to skate to the where the puck's going to be, right?
Sure, it's exactly right. And you know, and so far, whenever I write my reports, I just wrote a report for Mohawk Trail on enrollment. If people are interested, like, you know, it's online, and I always look at the BRPC Mark Malloy's. His track record, and he's got a really good track record of being very, very close. You might see some manipulation or movement around individual districts, but the overall picture remains just about the same. Mm. So, when enrollment goes down, you know, you have to sort of ask the question, how do we most efficiently use our resources?
Right.
Because some of the decline is not, it's kind of that slow heated pot effect where it's so subtle each year that it's not like you can just cut programs and cut teachers, right?
Right. It's not a one-for-one.
It's not a one-for-one. Yeah. It's not like, hey, we lost a first-grade group of kids. No, we might have lost four first-grade kids. Mm-hmm. That's not enough to eliminate a section. So so really, it's you have to look out over multiple years to say, where will we be and how do we plan for that so we have the right size staffing? And then as districts get smaller, and some of the small districts in Berkshire County have challenges just providing the range of resources. You know, we are comprehensive school systems, which means we try to do everything for everybody. You know, we're not Miss Halls. We're not a college prep, sending kids all to college, ideally elite colleges or highly competitive colleges, right?
Yeah.
We take students who have language, don't speak English, have special education needs, all the way up to kids who are going to those elite colleges, and we try to program for all of that in some of these small settings, and it can be a real challenge.
And then there are also, as you mentioned earlier, the sort of state regulations, which have only increased, right? The number of things that the state is requiring of small and large public school districts.
Yeah.
The things that you can't avoid, you have to continue to provide for groups of students. You have to continue to report on what you've done. And all of those things take resources as well. So again, it's not like the one-room schoolhouse. You've got a whole cadre of people, you know, behind trying to make up for that level of reportability as well, accountability.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into that, and that's a good point. In the smaller districts where, you know, you don't have necessarily the size of a back office that you have in Pittsfield that might be managing things like grants and regulatory reporting, audits, things of that sort, you know, you have the principal and superintendent who are sort of scrambling to do it all, and that becomes a bit inefficient, you know. Those are some of the areas where we ask the question, you know, is it efficient to have everybody filing that same grant, given the size of the districts that we have, or everybody completing that audit, because that requires a decent amount of resources. To your point, and as you also point out, every year there's more legislation filed for schools to do more, and it's one of those things. When I was in Pittsfield and I was part of the Urban Superintendents Network, that we talked a lot about, which was, can we get a better handle on what exactly the Department of Ed and the state is requiring of the schools so that there's a full understanding of how much effort this takes, and then maybe try to scale that down in a way that, you know, creates a little bit better efficiency in how we do that work. So, you make a really good point. And those are things that the general public really doesn't have any sense of.
Right.
You know?
And sort of lay the land for people, if you will, about the sort of landscape of the schools that are in Berkshire County, because you sort of mentioned urban districts, which we certainly have here in Pittsfield, North Adams. And then you have some smaller, I would almost call them suburban districts, but they aren't really, we don't really have suburbs here in the Berkshires, I don't think.
Right.
And then you have some very small rural schools, right? So talk about the differences and the challenges that each one of those face.
Yeah, it's interesting. By state law, every town has to have an educational plan for its kids. And it can do that in a number of ways. It can run its own school system within its municipality. That happens, obviously, in Pittsfield. It happens in Lenox. It happens, for the most part, in Lee, North Adams. It can also partner with a neighboring district and form a region. And so we have a number of regional districts. Mount Greylock is one, Central Berkshire, Berkshire Hills, Southern Berkshire. And then there are school unions, which are sort of like regions, but they remain sort of independent in the school committee structure, but they share sort of central office administrative staff. And then within all that, we have a handful of districts that are towns that don't run full K-12 districts. They run K-6 or K-8. And so as a result...
And those are the closest things to the one-room schoolhouse idea, right?
The idea
that you could still have a small elementary school in your small town. I mean, when I say small, we're talking like just, you know, hundreds of people in the town totally. Right. And a total number of probably dozens of kids.
Yeah, right. I think Hancock is 58 kids total. Yeah. So, I think a lot of what we've seen around the Northeast as we sort of look at the research on this is that there is a real protectiveness or sensitivity around retaining elementary schools close to home and having ownership in that. But folks also know the realities of offering secondary education in high school in a small setting like that is really difficult. And so that's where you see a school district like Hancock that runs its elementary schools, or Richmond, and then it sends its kids to a high school through either a formal relationship or through a tuition agreement where kids have the choice to go to a couple of high schools. Mm.
And just explain why it's harder to run a a middle school or a high school, let's say, or a junior high school. In a small town with, let's say, take Hancock, for example, where you have a K-6 and they can function, they can make that work.
Yeah.
But when you get to the high school level, it's harder. Why is that?
That's a good question. You're asking a really good question, Tayshaun. You're always right on top of things.
It's the coffee. Right?
I like that about you. It's always a good interview. If you think about elementary school and sort of the traditional form, and you think about your own experience, elementary schools in great part run similar to that. There's definitely some things that have been added around. So think about that. You have a first grade teacher.
Yeah.
And that you have that teacher all day long for the most part. And that teacher teaches you all the content areas. Mm-hmm. They teach you English. They teach you writing. They teach you math. They teach you social studies. They teach you science.
Fair to say that hasn't changed as much, maybe.
It hasn't. Yeah. It hasn't. I mean, there are some unique models out there where you get regrouping in elementary schools. Some of the most sort of progressive elementary school models in Berkshire County, and some of the really interesting principals have done masterful but complicated work to sort of reorganize kids. In some schools, you might get some content differentiation where you have a teacher teaching like science and in math and then social studies and English. So the kids will swap between two teachers.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's a child is with an elementary teacher for the day. Mm. They might get pulled out for a special like art or phys ed, but that's their teacher.
Okay.
When you get to high school, it's totally different. It's all a middle school, high school, it's content driven. And so you have teachers who have certification in a content area, math, science, social studies, English, whatever. And the children travel to those teachers to take those courses. And so what becomes hard, particularly in small high schools, is to schedule the range of courses that you want to offer, given the size. Mm. So let's say, for example, in ninth grade, you have a handful of kids who are not ready for algebra. You need to run pre-algebra. You got a handful of kids who are ready for algebra. You got to run algebra. Mm. And then you got a handful of kids who are advanced who want to jump into geometry. So you got three classes with a handful of kids, and the reality is that's going to be really difficult to run them all.
Yeah, if you had a small school, that might be one teacher struggling to do all those three things for those different kids.
That's right.
And then if you start, I suppose, to get into that specialization, it becomes more expensive.
Right.
Right?
Because
now you're looking at better facilities, more teachers, more curriculum, more back office stuff, right? All the stuff we talked about at the beginning.
Yes, that's true. And then on top of that, which is really the thing that makes it expensive, is you end up with really small class sizes.
Mm.
Now, you're going to have people say, well, that's good. Small class sizes are awesome.
Right. That seems to be desirable for a lot of people.
Desirable. Mm-hmm. We want 7-8 kids in a class. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But you know, for, you know, if you got 7-8 kids in one district, and let's just take a calculus as a high level course, right? And then in the next district, you got 8. That 15 really is a good size section, yet you're paying an additional teacher to teach a section. And so as a result, the cost of running those courses, those singleton courses in that school, become more expensive. And that's why you see the cost of running rural schools higher than in a place like Pittsfield.
Yeah. And so I guess that leads to the question about the small schools and what hit the newspaper in the last couple weeks, specifically about Hancock, but then also about some other smaller districts in Berkshire County, and I think a total of 10 districts across the state that were affected by a rule that I guess hadn't been enforced for a long time, and now the State Department of Education, DESE, has decided to enforce it, right, to say... and maybe you can explain it a little bit better, why it is that when the smaller schools are taking in school choice kids, and I know we need to get a discussion about school choice, that then they are sending their kids with an agreement, as you mentioned before, to a high school, to a larger district, that there's some problems with how to fund that, how to fund the school choice kids coming in and then going to a different district. So kind of, and again, we're here on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM talking with Jake Eberwine. Go ahead on that.
Yeah, well, let's just start generally with just explaining to people what school choice is.
Yeah, back up here.
So yeah, we'll back up a little bit. And it's interesting because, again, for some of us who are older, not crazy old, like my mom and dad, but older, we remember that we went to school where we lived. The end of story. You move into a community, that community has a school, you go to it. If you want to go to another school outside that community, you pay.
Yeah.
Whether that's a private school, a parochial school, or even a neighboring public school, you would pay tuition to do that.
Yeah.
When education reform came into play in 1993, it was greatly influenced by the Mass Business Alliance for Education, Education Alliance, I'm going to get that wrong. You know, one of the tensions in public education is this notion of a free market. And so in a free market, you allow children to go to school wherever they want. Just like you can go to any grocery store you want, you go to any school you want. That wasn't the case before ed reform. What school choice did is it opened the door for that. To that, children, if a district was accepting students from outside its boundaries, its geographic boundaries, those children from outside could apply to become part of that school district.
The school district that was taking those kids in for students from a different district, they had to agree to accept them in, right? So they could decide whether or not to accept them, but they couldn't decide whether or not to let them go. So if your students from your district wanted to school choice into somewhere else, the town or the city had nothing to say about that.
That's exactly right. That gets people a little bit confused. Like, can't we block kids from leaving?
Yeah.
And so that's exactly right. School committees on an annual basis have to decide that, actually, they have to decide that they're not going to participate in choice. By default, they're participating in choice. And if they vote not to participate in choice or to set limits at grade levels, they may only have 5 seats open, then they can vote to do that in a particular grade span, and that's how they advertise. But they cannot block students from leaving the district. And so this created a little bit of a free market phenomenon that my take on this, having lived through it, is that it took a little while to catch on. And I think as consumers, parents, families, kids became more savvy that they could do this, it has grown. And particularly in places like in Berkshire County, where you might actually live closer to the school in your neighboring town than you do to the one in your own town.
Right.
So, or that school might have a program that you're interested in.
The original idea, of course, as you mentioned, free market would be to stoke competition, I suppose. so that school districts, in theory, would improve so that they would compete with neighboring school districts and prevent their students from going to a different district. But that all of that doesn't really figure in as much, it seems like, as in this smaller rural school district issue, such as Hancock,
yeah.
where you've got kids, families choicing into Hancock, maybe for that small school feel that we mm-hmm. talked about before. But then they know that when they get to that sixth grade level, there's going to be some decisions to be made there, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yep. And I do think that probably the Mass Business Alliance and the sort of the general spirit behind free market is competition elevates quality. Again, you know, we can get economists and sociologists and psychologists in to make that argument. I won't make that. But I think there's a flip side of that coin, and the idea is that there's an equity question here. And, you know, should a child in a failing school be limited to only going to that failing school? Should they have options to go to a school that's not failing? And so there's always been programs that have, in effect, shipped kids from failing schools or urban centers out to suburban centers in some successful ways, including the Metco program in Boston. So so I think there are two sides of the sort of that competition yeah. equity coin. But yeah.
And so after 30 years, we've got some data, I suppose, now. Has it worked? Has it been something that's been successful, school choice?
well, I guess the question is...
Depends on who you talk to, I guess, right?
I guess the question is, what's the measure of success?
Yeah.
You know, is it... I'd say that one of the things that, you know, when this was derived in 1993, they set a dollar figure that hasn't changed. And I know I was quoted in the paper as saying that my take on school choice is it's a half measure. I would stand by those words because the dollars that flow into the receiving district are not enough to actually support the education of that child.
And the dollars are flowing from one school district to another, just to be clear, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And then the dollars that flow from a school district just financially damage that district because they accumulate and then that district has to make choices around how they prepare their budget. So,
but if the dollar amount hasn't changed in 30 years, right. obviously the value of the dollar certainly has, right? So
that's exactly right.
That isn't a realistic number anymore of what it costs to educate a child in a different district.
That's exactly right. And so if you were going to go into a full free market system, and a better example of a free market system is the vocational school ecosystem in Massachusetts, which actually does work with the state to set tuition at market rate. So, you know, I'm just going to throw a number out that's in the ballpark, but let's say that a vocational student costs $20,000. It's about right. If you live in Dalton and you and your child wants to go to McCann, they can go to McCann, and Dalton's on the hook for the $20,000 tuition plus transportation. So, you know, that would be a more realistic number if we really were to go to a free market system.
Right.
That would dramatically change things because the sending districts would get hit even harder on the school choice out money. Although there's been some legislative, you know, rumblings around could you cap the damage done sort of the fiscal liability to ascending district at some level so they didn't get so damaged that it sort of hurt their core instruction, their core work, core operations.
Well, and we're coming up to that halfway break here in the show, and I've got a few questions swimming around my head. And one of which is after I asked about whether this has been a success and we talked about how you determine what the success is, the question I'll ask you after the break will be, okay, you've let students leave, quote unquote, failing district. Has that helped that failing district at all? That will be the question I ask Jake Eberwein when we come back from our break at the top of the hour. This is 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. This is Morning Drive, and we'll be right back to talk more with Jake Eberwein right after this. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Now, there is one final message for you to transmit to Earth. It is the most important message you have ever sent. I want you to keep repeating it as many times as possible.
89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from the Office of Cultural Development in Pittsfield. The next First Fridays at 5 is June 7th and will feature a community sponsor, Berkshire Pride, a Jacob's Pillow interactive performance, live music from Happy Together at the City Stage, and much more. Don't miss First Fridays at 5 on North Street in downtown Pittsfield. For more details, go to lovepittsfield.com. And UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass. Now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
Have you ever dreamed of being a radio DJ, spinning your favorite vinyl, CDs, and MP3s? Have you ever wanted to share conversations with interesting guests with the community? Then the WTBR-FM Programming Committee wants to hear from you. We are now accepting proposals for new programs. For more information, visit WTBRFM.com or call 445-4234. Pittsfield Community Radio, for the love of radio.
What is One Berkshire? We're the voice of the business.
Hello, wonderful people. This is your host, Harry Pinkston, for the show. 30 minutes of inspiration coming on every Friday, 12:30 p.m. to 1 p.m. So that 12:30 slot is a time to help fill cups, fill your gas tank, and just give you a reboot for the day. 30 minutes of inspiration coming on every Friday at 12:30 p.m. Fill the gas tank, and I hope to see you there every Friday, 12:30 p.m. here on WTBR.
The preceding public service announcement courtesy of WTBR and Lee Bank. Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is community. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings, and screen rooms. Customized solutions available. Online at Sandrini.com.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR.
And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you on Thursday, June 6th, and we are going to continue our conversation with Dr. Jake Eberwein, the project director of Berk 12, all about schools, school choice, regionalization, rural schools, you name it, everything to do with education here this morning. First, another look at the weather forecast and see what's in store for us coming up today. Here we go.
Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers likely. Isolated thunderstorms this morning, then scattered thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. Southeast wind around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Tonight, mostly cloudy with showers likely with scattered thunderstorms in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Lows in the upper 50s. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 60%. Friday, mostly sunny. A chance of showers in the afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. West wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 50%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, you heard it. Make sure you keep those umbrellas and raincoats handy today, and watch out for those thunderstorms. Only 60% chance of that, but you know that means it's going to happen. We're going to get rain.
We're due.
Yeah, we're due. Definitely. Jake Eberwein, thanks again for being here this morning and talking to us about this very important topic. So I left with a cliffhanger at the end there. Has school choice helped those sending districts, the quote unquote failing school districts, at all? And is this a good plan to help school districts succeed?
Yeah, the big concern I've had with school choice from the very beginning is that it can hollow out urban school districts, and as a result, you know, what's left behind, in terms of resources, and students can just elevate challenges. What I don't like about school choice, and we didn't really get to this and maybe a little bit in the article, is that it's a discriminating process, and meaning that families have to know how to navigate choice. So
you have to be informed, right? You have to be in the loop, as it were.
You have to be in the loop. Mm-hmm. You have to fill out paperwork. You have to know what the deadlines are. And that in and of itself will eliminate a lot of families. Mm. And then two, if you get accepted, you have to provide your own transportation.
Mm.
So those are two things that...
Not
everybody can do that. Yeah. Now, there are some districts that will run a bus up to the town line or whatever and say, hey, we'll pick you up here. But generally, those are two things that, in my opinion, you know, create a little bit of a bit of an uneven playing field, which is why I often refer to school choice as the half measure, half on the finance and really half on this notion of equity, where it's all about sort of creating equitable access for kids where it really doesn't, because it's got these discriminating features to it. So I'm not, you know, I would say that we've done a little bit of research in Pittsfield, and really the migration mostly from Pittsfield to Lenox and Center Berkshire. And we definitely found that, you know, there the composition of students leaving doesn't necessarily match the composition of students in the aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not as poor and they're not as diverse. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
That
has a big change on the demographics of schools as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly Lenox and Central Berkshire might become a tad more diverse, but not at the same, you know, sort of ratios that we see in Pittsfield.
Mm-hmm.
So I just did a data set yesterday for Mohawk Trail we're working right now, and they also have in-migration and out-migration, and we also found very similar things where the in-migration of special ed students is a much higher percentage than their general population.
Into that particular district?
Into that district. Mm-hmm. And the theory is that, you know, their special ed programs are perceived as high quality. Mm-hmm. But that also saddles that district with additional, you know, challenges and burdens on providing services for those students.
Which I would think would be more expensive in general.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. And there is a special ed increment in the school choice where if additional services are required, they get more money than just the $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, it's a lot. For districts to take on. And so we saw a bit of that when I was in Lee for the 2 years, and that was something we definitely, we felt like Lee was known for some very strong special ed programs. As a result, we got some school choice in, but...
Is there an average amount that it costs to educate a non-special ed student in Berkshire County? Because $5,000 is the amount that the state allows for school choice.
Yeah.
What's the general range for educating a student in a year?
It's somewhere between 16 and 24.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I mean, that's shockingly different.
Shockingly different, yeah. We have a, there's a formula in the state in which a foundation budget is created. And a foundation budget is basically... what is the minimum that would be required to provide an adequate education for children in your community?
Mm-hmm.
But most every school district spends well beyond that, what we call the required budget, which is the foundation, which is a combination of local contribution and state aid.
Mm-hmm.
Communities then pony up a lot more beyond that, which they don't have to, but they do.
Mm.
That really is ultimately what elevates the cost to the levels that we're seeing, and that it continue to climb.
And so that kind of leads us to the next question, which is, okay, you've got your students in the K-6 small rural school, let's say, example, Hancock, but then also there are schools like, was it Farmington River District?
Yeah.
And the one in Clarksburg, the school union up there. How many in Berkshire County? There were five or six?
Yeah, I think there was five or six schools that qualified. Richmond was another one.
Yeah. And so now your students have graduated sixth grade, and they're school choiced into your district from another town, and they want to go to a high school in a different district, right? Which you have the ability, maybe you have an agreement with that town or with that district to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And the state has now said, well, you know, That town, Hancock or whatever, you're going to be on the hook for the full amount of that to pay that because these kids choiced in from somewhere else at $5,000, right, a student.
That's right.
But now the cost of going to Mount Greylock is $17,000 or $20,000.
Yeah.
And so Hancock and places like that are starting to put in petitions, home rule petitions. Tell us how this red tape works and why it's a difficulty for the towns and the families.
Yeah, well, this is sort of, as the Eagle pointed out, and it was a well-written and researched article. I appreciated the work that they did on that. As they found out, this is a somewhat new interpretation of a regulation that's been on the books since 93. And the idea, basically the reference in the regulation is that students can affect stay with their cohorts. So they, you know, they come to an elementary school, they create friends, connections.
Yep. Very and important.
So as a result, they can stay with their cohorts. I don't know. Like I was talking to Bill Ballin, who was in Hancock for a while, and he said, we never interpreted it this way. But the new interpretation, and I'm not sure what precipitated this. I assume someone reached out who was, you know, kind of either a policy wonk or someone who was really sort of, you know, sharpening the pencil on the finances and asked the question, you know, who should be paying for that?
Yeah.
So the idea is that when a school choice student enters a school district, they become that school district's child.
Right.
You can't send the kid back.
Yeah.
Okay, there's no like, oh, you got in trouble, you got suspended on Tuesday, we're just going to ship you back to your school. Or your services were too much. Nope.
Yeah. No.
You take them, you own them.
Huh.
And so now it's not only that, but you own them for the duration of whatever relationship you have with your secondary school. So, as I mentioned earlier, Hancock doesn't have a high school. So by state regulation, they have to have an arrangement for their children to be educated in a high school. So they have tuition agreements with a number of high schools, one being Greylock.
Yeah, which is probably the closest geographically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so as a result...
Or at least for part of Hancock. Hancock is one of those odd... towns where it's split in the middle. You really can't get from one part of Hancock to the other without leaving Hancock. So there's a southern section, which might be actually closer to Pittsfield High schools, for example.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So so really the bottom line here is that the new interpretation is that Hancock, the town, would be on the hook for the tuition that they pay to Mount Greylock to educate kids that they've taken in on choice. And that's a new interpretation.
Interesting.
So,
and that takes effect now, this year, next year?
That's the understanding of that. This is it doesn't even really need to, the take effect is the regulation's been in place. It's just now that folks are going to hold you to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, Hancock would still get the $5,000, say that child was coming from Pittsfield. And then they would then turn around and pay the tuition, but it's going to be more expensive than you know what they're you know currently paying to educate that child in the elementary school. So you know there's this question of fairness. I mean, I can give you another example. Another example is and we face this a little bit in South County in Berkshire Hills. Berkshire Hills is likely going to build a new high school. They're going to have a Chapter 74 vocational programs. Chapter 74 tuition is set. In part with the partnership of the state, as I used earlier, the number 20,000, we'll stick with that, right? Berkshire Hills accepts a child from Southern Berkshire in grade five, $5,000. They go through six, through seven, through eight, and then in ninth grade, they go up to Monument, and they join a Chapter 74 program. Well, you'd think they could go back to that child's town in Southern Berkshire and charge the $20,000,
which would be the higher rate for vocational education.
For vocational.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Because that child's a choice student that they accepted as theirs, nope. Huh. They only continue to get the $5,000. And so that becomes a problem on the receiving side, which is why no vocational school in Berkshire in Massachusetts accepts choice kids. It's not a good deal. They basically, you're going to come in through tuition or through membership, and that's it. Those are the two ways you come into a high school vocational school. Wow. So, yeah.
So many small loopholes like that. And maybe, you know, again, a law that was passed in 1993 maybe hasn't kept up with the times in some ways and hasn't closed some of those loopholes that affect smaller rural or regional districts here in Berkshire County that maybe at a higher rate than it does in other parts of the state.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's kind of funny. When we talk about school choice across the state, it doesn't really catch people's attention. Mm. Yeah, we've been talking about it at the task force level since 2015.
Right.
Is a real driver. You know, the enrollment strategy right now in Berkshire County, I hate to say it, but it's really how do we pull kids from neighboring districts?
Mm.
If we can keep kids coming into our district from neighboring districts, we can maintain our cohort size,
mm-hmm.
which allows us to offer the robust set of programs and services.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a place like Lenox, where I served as interim a year ago for 6 months, and you know, half the kids there are school choice kids.
Hmm.
So if school choice wasn't,
we have to sort of say that again. Half the kids in a school district are school choice kids from other districts.
Yeah, yeah,
that's amazing.
It's amazing.
Really,
yeah,
you know, again, going back to what we said at the very beginning of the show, where when we grew up, you know, you went to a place, you were a school, it was your school that was in your town or city, and that's where you went.
Right.
And it went from that to some districts that have 50% of students from outside their area.
Yeah, I mean, we're working in Roe right now. They have 61 students and 23 are resident.
Mm.
So they're more than 50% non-resident.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's, I mean, they're basically maintaining their schools. You know, on with choice students in, which also is financially challenging for them because they're only getting $5,000, yet they've got to service kids at the same level. And so, it's really it's a decision that places like, you know, Lenox and even Berkshire Hills, which I think about half of their high school is choice in, you know, have got to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, school choice works for receiving districts when you got 18 kids in a class and you put three more in and there's 21 and it hasn't really changed much, right?
Right.
Don't need an additional teacher.
Kind of at the margins.
The margins, mm-hmm. right? When you start adding additional classes and staff, it's not such a great deal financially for the host community.
Yeah. So here's a question, and it was sort of brought up in that article. Is this a way for the state to push the idea of regionalization even stronger than they have? And I know that you've been involved in many discussions about regionalization right here in Berkshire County. It has its pluses and minuses for sure. I know we've talked about that before. Is that sort of the undercurrent of this, that they want more regionalization, that they want to see these smaller schools closed or merged into larger districts?
I think I'm going to say something that I haven't said that often, and that is I think the state has given up on regionalization.
Really?
Yes, they do.
Interesting.
They're not actually providing much money anymore for studies and for work. You know, we're not Vermont, we're not Maine, where they came in strong with regulations and said, we're going to provide some incentives and technical support to help you do this. And if you don't do it, we're going to have some penalties, but we're going to start with incentives. Massachusetts has just not done that. What they've done for the last 10 years is put out a lot of money and we've been the recipient of that money to do some studies to help communities work through the process. And I think beyond that, they've written a lot of papers that sort of, you know, we just did a literature study on all the research that's been done in this and all the challenges that exist in getting regionalization done. I think we're not seeing much in the way of regionalization. I think because the state hasn't necessarily felt that the investment that they've put into regionalization has yielded.
Hmm.
But these are incredibly, incredibly hard, complicated projects.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, you know, school committees are not designed to basically write themselves out of existence, right?
Right, and there are so many other issues, and I just spotlight the recent one in the last couple of years with Southern Berkshire and Berkshire Hills,
right,
where they were talking about combining those two districts for a number of reasons, resources, buildings. But then the challenges are transportation, I suppose, and and how far a student has to go for a school. And does it feel like it's your hometown school anymore, or are you really just shipping your kids somewhere else? I'm sure all of those discussions were had, but in the end, that was a process that fell apart, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were the project facilitator in that for 2.5 years, and
that's a long time to put into something that looked for a while like it was, you know, kind of a done deal. It's like, why wouldn't you do this? It makes so much sense. And yet, at the end of the day, what was it about that regionalization effort that finally just didn't work?
I think people are really, really, it's difficult for them to accept their school closing. Mm. And in this case, it really boiled down to the school closure. And it wasn't really a closure, because we were going to build a new high school that wasn't Monument and wasn't Mount Everett. Mm. It was a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And which needed a new name, needed a new mascot. But still, I think even the fact that we're talking about situating that on the Great Barrington campus, not in Sheffield, all those things had the feel that there was loss, right?
Mm.
And I think when a community loses a school, it is a community center.
It's an identity.
It's an identity. Yeah. We heard the word identity a lot throughout the study as a challenge. We specifically went hands off on the elementary schools because we knew that was something people wanted to protect. But we also heard pretty consistently that folks wanted a bigger pond for the high school kids. They wanted more programs. They wanted a wider range of programs. And so, that was reflected in the proposal. But there were just a lot of little things. We had to write a new regional agreement. There were things in that regional agreement that were part of a whole new way of thinking about finance, how you finance schools. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a creative process that we did through partnership with our committee. But even folks had questions about that in the 11th hour. But at the end of the day, we really feel good about that process. And a lot of folks were like, well, you didn't get it done. I'm like, actually, we did get it done. And then our job is to allow the voters to weigh in.
Yep.
At the end of the day, the voters have got to make the decision.
Absolutely.
And then they've got to live with the decisions, you know. And so now,
because that decision also has a consequence going forward for the next generation of students and families and taxpayers and everything else, right? That is going to be hard to come back and revisit, I would imagine.
I think it's, there's moments in where you're positioned to do something this substantial, and those moments tend to be things when there's a budget crunch and you just have to really sort of roll up your sleeve. When you have a building project is an absolute ideal time to talk about right-sizing your building.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that quite a bit. Let's get this thing the right size.
Yeah.
When you have leadership changes is often a time, both of those, if you were to have two superintendents changing over, it might be an opportunity to sort of think about combining. So those are moments where you can start to sort of, they can be sort of the spark plug to get districts to have these conversations. But the actual execution decision-making is really challenging. And I think, coming back to this question around state, if regionalization is going to happen as we look forward, and I'm not suggesting that the state should or shouldn't do this, it's probably going to have to involve more state intervention.
Okay.
And I would say we start with incentives. We do real incentives to say, if you two come together, we will, pay for transition costs. We will support transportation 100%. Mm. We will do some things that make it financially attractive to help get you out of the gate.
Sweeten the pot, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right. So.
And so, and again, I think about how different this probably is in Berkshire County in Western Massachusetts versus some of the other areas in Eastern Mass, where maybe the state is more highly focused and sees that as the reality versus coming out here and seeing that, things are much different and the needs are different.
I completely agree with you. If you look at the concentration of where kids are in the state, they're in urban cities, they're in gateway cities, and they've got their hands full.
Mm-hmm. Or some of them are in very wealthy suburban districts also.
Absolutely, right, and wealthy suburban districts. So, but what I like to say, whenever I get a chance to talk to legislators, is that rural education is actually relatively inexpensive when you look at the grand amount of money, the total money that's being pushed into public education. Mm-hmm. We're a pretty small number.
Yeah.
And so it's actually a relatively inexpensive fix. You can pump a little bit more money into rural, help sort of facilitate these changes, and I think not be break the budget. I think right now rural aid that has been basically allocated by the state as a starting point. Personally, I like to see that aid distributed a little bit differently than it is. I'd like to see more money go into incentivizing collaborative work and potential regionalization studies so that we can get further into the weeds of what it would take to actually get to long-term sustainability. But right now it's flowing into rural districts to help offset some of these unique costs, and I think it's a good starting point.
Do you think there's an appetite at the state level to make the changes necessary to make some of this more successful here in the western part of the state, or do you think that they're letting sleeping dogs lie in some ways?
It seems that they've been, you know, sort of peripherally hands off. And I don't want to say that they've completely been out of it, because we work with two really talented folks at Department of Ed who've been invested in this work for 20, 30 years and written papers on it. And I think, you know, when I came into the superintendency in Pittsfield, Mitchell Chester was the then commissioner, and he, one of his opening statements was, "You're not a district if you're under 5,000 kids." Huh. And it was very controversial what he said, because it was more like people were seeing in Maine and in Vermont with, hey, we got to deal with these smaller districts. They're just not efficient. Kids aren't getting the same services, and we need it differently. But
that's an eye-opener, though. 5,000 kids. I mean, that's basically where Pittsfield Public Schools is right now.
That's correct. Right. So you'd have one district. Right? I mean, we had proposed, obviously, the task force. We got in a little bit of trouble when we proposed a district-wide county, the county-wide district. But, you know, you could also probably organize yourself into a south, central, and north school districts and do it in a pretty effective way. So, it's interesting stuff.
Certainly be a conversation that will continue to unfold as time goes on. It's there's never the end of these conversations, it seems like, and it's good to be able to talk about that. Jake Eberwein's my guest here this morning, project director of Burke 12. In the couple minutes that we've got left, we never really kind of set the table for that. Tell us a little bit about Burke 12 and other projects that you're involved with.
Yeah, because Burke 12, our task force was all about sort of researching how to organize districts. We also felt that we needed to start actually doing work, doing something to help. And so we said, let's forget about regionalization. Let's start doing collaborative work. Let's just start doing collaborative work. So we morphed into this organization called Burke 12, and we do a variety of things. We work on professional development. So you'll know, like on election day in November, we run the countywide professional development. We're doing a number of other things, you know, working on mentoring and induction programming, literacy instruction, a variety of things in the professional development domain. We're doing a multi-high school sort of reform project in concert with the Barr Foundation. And that's it's called A Portrait of a Graduate. And those schools have been working on it for almost 4 years now, and we're about to get another 3-year grant.
Cool.
It's Taconic, Pittsfield High, Hoosick, Drury, Bart, and Monument. So we've got a great consortium of high schools that actually work together. They talk, they meet, they do trips to other schools in the Northeast, across the U.S. actually. And it's been a really great experience for them to think about how to do business differently.
Feels like we're almost out of time here, but we'll have another show where we talk about that. Because that, I think we can do a whole show just on those projects.
For sure.
Jake Eberwein, thanks so much for being here this morning. It's been great
welcome.
Talking to you. Love it, and we'll do more.
I appreciate the time and being with you today.
You bet.
All right. Thanks. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. And I'll be back. Brian Burkle will be your guest host tomorrow morning here on Morning Drive, and he has a great show coming up with Berkshire Natural Resources Council. Talk to you soon.